Okay, let's begin. I'm Lisa Lippincott. I am here to try and answer this question, what is the basic interface? And I won't pretend that I have a complete answer for you today. What I have is actually three answers, all of which are incomplete, even taken together, but I think they point in the right direction, and I think that this is a question that we need to get answered. So first, this is a sequel of sorts to a talk I gave a year and a half ago at CPP Now called How We Reason About Procedural Programs. That talk is on YouTube. You can watch it later if you like. But the important takeaway is this. We routinely prove that our programs work. If we didn't prove our programs work, they would hardly ever work. You can't explain the success of our computer programs by chance alone. Second point, and feel free to interrupt me with questions if you have questions, but second point, the proof behind a well-written program is mostly evident in its text. We expect that if a program is well-written, you can pick it up and read the code and figure out why it works. And if it's well-written but buggy, you ought to be able to pick it up and read the code and figure out why it doesn't work. But sometimes the proof we intended is wrong. Either our logic is faulty, we've missed a case, or something that we didn't that we thought was true wasn't true, or maybe our logic in our head didn't match our code because there was a typo or something. Sometimes our intended proof doesn't quite work. And of course, that leads to bugs. Not all bugs. Some programs are defective by design. But it leads to a lot of bugs, and we will see some of those later. But this leads to an interesting question. Why aren't we having computers check our proofs? And I think a big part of the answer, having thought about this question for a while, is this. We generally aren't clear about what we're trying to prove. In particular, in function interfaces, we don't write down formal requirements and expectations of the function. And there's, to some extent, a reason for that. Our best formal notation for doing proofs is mathematical notation that's like 200 years old. It goes back to a crisis in mathematics that happened in the 1800s. And a new mathematics arose out of that crisis based on an idea called Platonism. Platonism is the idea that mathematical concepts, like five, exist in a timeless, unchanging parallel universe that we reason about, we access through the eye of our imagination, or if you go back to the original, Plato thought that we accessed it by remembering it from before we were born. It's actually a little crazy when you think about it closely, but it's given us mathematics that has worked pretty well for 200 years. Except, because these things are off in their timeless universe, it is hard to talk about them changing. We have mathematics that is hostile to change. And this isn't a problem with reasoning. We are good at reasoning about change, and we do manage to work mathematics about change. But the problem is it has poor user interface for discussing change, and it has therefore has poor user interface for discussing procedural programs. Now, one approach would be to write a different sort of program in which nothing ever changes. And that approach has been tried for about 50 years with limited success. I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to say our reasoning should embrace change. I'm going to write mathematics procedurally and integrate it into programs. So, moving on to the next thing, we don't write down all the details of function interfaces. And that's maybe not obvious, but I think it will be by the end of the talk that there's a lot of niggling details that we expect of pretty much every function that we let go unsaid because pretty much every function is like that. But we should at least agree on what the things that can go unsaid are. And that leads us to this talk. The basic interface is the set of expectations we have about a function before we write down the documentation. And if we want a function that does more than the basic interface says, we will add to that. And if we want to weaken it some way, we will remove things from the basic interface. But the blank sheet of paper that we start with is the basic interface. It's the standard expectations, a function doing the usual things. But before we go further, I have to talk a little about interfaces and how we write down interfaces. And now I'm going to play fantasy C++. I'm going to invent new bits of the language to cover the things I want to say. And here is the first one. This is a function interface. It looks a lot like an inline function. And in fact, it has two salient parts, always inline, and it may have this statement, implementation, somewhere in its outermost block. The implementation statement separates the interface into a prologue and an epilogue. Sorry, I thought I saw a hand, but no. And what does the implementation statement do? The implementation statement invokes the function implementation. It's very like a function call. Our execution path runs through the prologue, through the implementation body, back for the epilogue. It's unlike a function call in three ways. One, it doesn't choose what to call. When a complete function is always composed of an interface and an implementation put together, and the implementation statement is just the jump across to the other part. So when a caller calls a function, they're calling an interface and an implementation together, and this just connects the two. Second thing, if there were parameters to the function, I know there aren't for this one, but if there were parameters, the parameters in the function interface are the same objects as the parameters in the function implementation. They're not copies. And that's going to be important because we are going to want to make assertions about L values as we get further. Third thing, the implementation produces the result of the function, unless it's void, of course. And the implementation returns something. The epilogue can examine the returned value using the identifier result. But the epilogue does not return its own value. It just, when the epilogue completes, the result of the implementation is the result of the whole function. I know that's a lot to grab right now, but we will see some examples in a bit. So if we had a function that calls this, say bar here, we have an execution path that runs through the pre-call region, through the prologue, through the implementation body, through the epilogue, and through the post-call region, as you might expect. Function call on the left, implementation connection, whatever we'll call that on the right. But I draw this not because I think that was unexpected, but because I'm going to be talking about local reasoning today. I'm going to be talking about covering our programs in a collection of neighborhoods that overlap and cover the execution path. And we're going to reason about the behavior of each neighborhood independently, and then use the fact that they have to agree in the overlapping regions in order to make global conclusions about the correctness of our program. So we divide this part of the execution path into two parts. A calling neighborhood, which includes the pre-call region, the prologue, a mysterious gap where the implementation happens, the epilogue, and the post-call region. And the other neighborhood is the implementation neighborhood, which has the prologue, the implementation body, and the epilogue, but knows nothing about the caller. We're going to talk about them independently, but note that the neighborhoods overlap in the interface. That's what an interface is. It's the overlapping portions of the neighborhoods. Where the neighborhoods overlap, we're going to put one of them in charge. One neighborhood is always responsible for anything that goes wrong, any undefined behavior. So in the prologue, the calling neighborhood is responsible for any undefined behavior. And I know you might be thinking, because people asked this last time I gave this talk, but whoever wrote the implementation might have written the interface. That's not the calling neighborhood's problem. The calling neighborhood just has to look at the interface and say, if I can't make the prologue work, I can't call the function. Likewise, the implementation neighborhood is responsible for the epilogue. If the implementation can't make the epilogue work, it must not return. And that's how we're going to piece things together, knowing the implementation gets to see what happens in the prologue, and the caller gets to see what happens in the epilogue, but they're not responsible for that. They know somebody else took care of that. It's also worth noting that each neighborhood fits in a single translation unit. Local reasoning like this gives us reasoning that can be checked on the translation unit level. So separately compiled proofs of correctness. The interface is, of course, in both translation units. That's why it's inline. Inline functions are functions that can be in more than one translation unit. So the translation units overlap, usually in a header file. That's where you generally put interfaces. So now we know about interfaces, we can return to the question of what's the basic interface. And I gave you one answer already, which is that the basic interface is what you have before you write anything down. Here's answer number two. This is the basic interface. It's what you have before you write anything down. I'm not going to end the talk here. The rest of the talk is going to be about what things are implicitly part of the basic interface, what things do not have to write down. And the first thing, no, not the first thing, thing zero of the basic interface, rule zero, is this. At the points where responsibility passes from one neighborhood to another, there must be no undefined behavior so far. And that is really the basis of all the reasoning we're going to see. If you can't get into the function without undefined behavior, then there's no way for the implementation to prove anything. The caller is responsible for making sure there's been no undefined behavior so far at the point the implementation is entered. And the implementation is responsible for there being no undefined behavior so far at the point control returns to the caller. And another bit of notation, I'm going to put the big blue dot next to things that can go unsaid. So blue dot means that's part of the basic interface. You don't have to write it down, but I'm writing it down. I'm writing it down anyway. Are we okay? Mm-hmm. I'm writing it down anyway because that's what this talk is about, writing down the things that you don't have to write down. One more case where there has to be no undefined behavior is a little trickier to write down. More notation. This is the fancy version of the implementation statement that gives us both an ordinary epilogue to execute when the implementation returns and an exceptional epilogue to execute when the implementation throws an exception or when the regular epilogue throws an exception. I'm going to say there has to be no undefined behavior so far when we exit by exception as well as when we return. Because again, you can't get anything without that guarantee. Worth noting, the return at the end of the regular epilogue and the throw at the end of the exceptional epilogue are implicit. I won't be writing them down for the rest of the talk. They've got the big blue dot next to them. So that's rule zero, but let's try something a little more practical. Here's a little function. I've given it the basic interface. It takes an integer reference in. It sets that integer to 5. And the question we're going to ask is, what could possibly go wrong? And here are three things that can go wrong. First thing, we write off the end of an array. Second thing, we write to deallocated memory. Third thing, we write to a constant. All of these things cause undefined behavior in the implementation function, or in the implementation of the function foo. They're dangerous in the callers, but the undefined behavior is in a different neighborhood. And that's something we have to find a way to avoid. If we're going to do local reasoning, we have to make sure the danger and the fire are in the same neighborhood. So what can we do to get the danger and the fire into the same neighborhood? We can write this, claim writable in the prologue. And again, I've just invented a couple of things, but the point of claim writable is to move the fire earlier in the program so that the undefined behavior happens in the same neighborhood as the danger. Once we do that, we can reason locally from the danger point to the undefined behavior point and see that there's really a problem. A little deeper, a claim is a kind of assertion. It's the mathematically provable assertion. Mathematically, it acts as an existential quantifier over execution paths. Any mathematicians in the room? Okay, one. Claim is an existential quantifier over execution paths. And writable is an expression. I've written out a slide for this one. Writable has no effect when assignment of an R value of type T to the L value has defined behavior. Otherwise, the behavior is undefined. So writable is a strange sort of function. It exists only to provide undefined behavior sometimes. It either does nothing or it has undefined behavior, depending on the conditions. But it's exactly what we need inside of this claim, because undefined behavior means you can't show there's an execution path through it. So the claim fails. There is no execution path if you can't write to the variable. If you can write to the L value, then there's an execution path. The claim succeeds. Anything? So moving on, I'm going to put the blue dot next to claim writable in this interface. I'm going to say, generally, when we pass in an integer reference, we mean for it to be writable. You don't even have to write that down. Integer reference means it means that the implementation gets to write to it. And similarly, we can have this sort of problem. Here, I've changed the implementation of the function. The implementation here reads from the variable that's been passed in. This variable is uninitialized. Again, danger in the caller, fire in the implementation. We need to get the danger and the fire into the same neighborhood. We do it the same way. We write claim readable in the prologue of the function. And readable, very much like writable. Readable has no effect when L value to R value conversion of the L value has defined behavior. Otherwise, the behavior of readable is undefined. So readable and writable, these are what I call capabilities. They name things that we aren't doing yet, but that we need to do later. And particularly, they name operations that are going to cause change or are going to be affected by changes. So, readable and writable, part of the basic interface here. I pass in an integer reference, I expect it to be readable and writable. Lisa. Yes?
So, since the interface is knowledgeable about the implementation, or at least the prologue is, why do we have to claim writable for this implementation?
For this implementation, perhaps we wouldn't. But I'm saying writable. Oh, the question is, why do we have to claim writable for this particular implementation? And the answer is, we could have written a different interface here. I'm saying this interface, the basic interface, the implicit thing, is going to be writable if you pass in an integer reference. And we will see later ways to avoid saying quite so much. But the thing you get for free for int ampersand is readable and writable. Likewise, we can reverse the situation. We can have danger in the implementation leading to undefined behavior in the caller, as in this case, where I've actually taken a variable that the caller passed in, destroyed it, constructed an uninitialized variable in that spot so that the caller won't be able to read from it. And that's kind of crazy. You should be thinking, that code is kind of crazy. You shouldn't do that. But if you're thinking, you shouldn't do that, then don't do that is probably part of the basic interface. So we will be seeing a lot of stupid code today showing reasons why don't do the stupid thing is part of the basic interface. But once again, I'm going to just, what did I just do? Is that not the same slide as before? Oh, I put in a different bug here, right? No? I read the wrong one. Ah, right, this one's writing to a constant. But we need that thing to be writable. And this one is what I described before. Sorry, I can't really, even for squeezing you over here, I can't really see this screen very well. And I'm used to looking at it. So this one was the one I described before. you can't read from that because we've managed to put an uninitialized variable where the initialized variable used to be. So we can solve both of these. Once again, we're going to claim readable and claim writable in the epilogue so that if you pass in an integer reference, we're going to say we expect the basic interface expects that it's readable and writable on the way in, readable and writable on the way out. And I'll go further. If there's an exception, the general expectation is that even if there's an exception, that variable is still readable and writable on the way out. So there we have some code that destroys the thing only, but only on the exception path. Don't do that. Don't do that as part of the basic interface. Now, if I keep this up, the interface is going to get very complicated indeed. I told you they were going to be complicated. I'm going to shorten it a little by inventing this function proper. A proper integer L value is one that is both readable and writable. And we're going to claim that the L value is proper in the prologue, in the regular epilogue, and in the exceptional epilogue here. Of course, if we pass in a const integer reference, we don't expect writable. If it's const, just readable. So proper is different for const integer references and integer references. More generally, proper is an assertion we can apply to an L value. It's specific to the CV qualified type. It's implicitly claimed at those three places: entry to the function, exit from the function, exit from the function with the exception. For parameters, function results, and thrown exceptions, there's some weasel words there about star this, because star this doesn't have to be proper before a constructor, when a constructor fails, or after destruction. But implicitly, these things are implicitly claimed proper immediately before responsibility is passed between neighborhoods. So proper for us is going to occupy the space of class invariant. It is the thing in the type system, is the way for the type system to affect the basic interface. But it's not quite the same as a class invariant. First, it's not invariant, it's just frequently asserted. We will be asserting that things are proper pretty often, but that doesn't mean they're proper all the time, just pretty often. Also worth noting that proper depends on the CV qualifiers. And that's something that class invariants don't get you because class invariants were invented for functional programming and there was no change. And so there was no CV qualifiers in functional programming. So that's proper. Back to our examples. Here we have another example where we have said we've implicitly claimed proper here. This variable is uninitialized. Turns out this function would have been fine with an uninitialized variable. It's just going to assign to it. So for this function, proper on entry is a little much. So I'm going to throw in a syntax that I'm not going to talk about much today, but I'm going to say you need a syntax, say this one, for saying proper doesn't apply to this particular interface. So this is an example of subtracting from the basic interface. We're going to say this integer isn't proper. Leaves us in a bit of a hole as to the writability of X, though. Now, in this example, knowing everything, we know that X will be writable. But locally, in the implementation neighborhood, there is no clue that X is writable. A different caller might have passed in a non-writable X. So we have this situation where in this caller, X is writable in a sort of global distance sense, but it's not writable in the neighborhood. It's not locally writable because we haven't been told. And we can have the reverse situation can also come up. Here, I've put claim writable into the interface. Now, locally writable in the implementation, but the caller doesn't know that X is going to be readable on the way out. So X, or I guess, yes, X is not locally readable after the function for the caller. And so we're going to have to put in a claim of propriety explicitly in the epilogue here. And now we're going to have to stick in a claim of writability in the exceptional epilogue. You might notice you start using improper, things get a little out of hand. You have to start writing a lot more stuff down. I think, therefore, this syntax is not quite right. I've got some better ideas, but so if you're a language designer, don't use that. It's not quite baked yet. But the point is, we need some relief from proper sometimes. On the other hand, that business of being locally writable is really neat. Because usually when we're asking, can we write to this variable? We don't mean, is it allocated to some part of our program? We mean, is it okay for this particular function we're writing to write to it? And you know, that's the situation we run into, the devastating situation with buffer overflows, for example. It's not that you are writing to something that'll cause a core dump because you wrote to it. That's bad, but worse, is you wrote over some other data that was important to some other part of your program that you weren't supposed to be writing. So locally writable is a much more interesting condition than globally writable. So I'm going to change the definition of writable to match it. Yes? The question is, in the exceptional epilogue here, why did I say claim writable instead of claim proper? That is, why am I not asserting that it's going to be readable if an exception is thrown? And the answer is, it's dangerous to claim more on an exception than you got on the way in from the prologue. Because if something goes wrong before you fix the variable, you're left with whatever you had when you, whatever properties you had when you came in. In this case, I know assignment to an int isn't actually going to throw an exception, so we would have been fine. We would have been fine if there weren't an exceptional epilogue at all, maybe. But more generally, claiming more in the exceptional epilogue than you get from the prologue is dangerous. Anything else? Okay. Locally writable. I am changing the definition of writable to the local version. This one has no effect when writable has been previously asserted in the responsible neighborhood more recently then the L value has been destroyed. And I know that more recently than the L value has been destroyed is kind of weasel words. We'll get to that later. But otherwise, the behavior is undefined. This is a weird definition. Here I'm saying you get writable from having previously asserted writable. But this is exactly what we want. In our implementation, we might want to assert writable. And the way we might get it from our in our implementation is by having asserted it in the prologue. But we're not responsible for the assertion in the prologue. The caller is responsible for the assertion in the prologue. And maybe it can make that assertion work because there's an assertion of writable in the caller's prologue. Or maybe it got it from the epilogue of a function it called. And each step of this chain is in a single neighborhood. The logical step is we've seen the writability asserted, and so we can assert it again in the same neighborhood when we are responsible. Each step is in one neighborhood, but the path crosses many neighborhoods because the assertions can appear in the interfaces where neighborhoods overlap. So writability traces a path from the construction of the object where it originates into interfaces, into more interfaces, out of epilogues, and to the place where we call it. So the global proof that the object is writable is this long path that it's taken to get to our claim. But the local proof is just, it was claimed up there in our prologue. Questions? Okay. Yes.
So by this definition, it seems that the very first writable assertion will always be undefined because there's no another one before it.
Ah, yes. So the question is, it seems like the very first writable assertion will be undefined. It will fail by this. Except there's this tiny parenthetical that I didn't actually speak, including as a consequence of construction. If you imagine constructing an integer to have an interface around it, the epilogue of that construction will give you writability. That is, constructing an integer gives you writability. Yes, some magic must have happened that the compiler provided when you declared a new integer, or that the library provided when you newed a new integer. But wherever it came from, it wasn't your neighborhood. It came from something below your neighborhood. So yes, it seems like it's turtles all the way down. And it kind of is. There are these tiny things that we rely on compiler magic for. Or if you like open up the compiler and see what's actually going on, it's not really magic. It's just that writability came from a byte on the stack that it knew was writable already, and it just handed us that writability. But from the point of view of a C++ programmer, there are turtles below at a level that we can't see. Anything else? Yes?
When writable has previously been asserted in the same neighborhood?
In the same neighborhood, in the responsible neighborhood. So you can, you know, the first writable in your neighborhood, not your problem, you're probably not responsible for it, because it's probably in your prologue or the epilogue. Oh, the question is previously asserted in the same neighborhood. And I mean previously asserted in the responsible neighborhood. Writable can be asserted in interfaces and be in more than one neighborhood at once. But the responsible neighborhood is the one that we care about. Assertion of writability for an object in your neighborhood ought to be one that you're not responsible for. And then after that, you can go to town. Readable, by the way, works the same way. No effect when readable has been previously asserted for that object. The little parenthetical is different here. It says, including as a consequence of initialization or assignment. So readability tracks a path much like writability. Readability comes from a previous readability, maybe in a prologue. In different neighborhood, it comes from maybe an epilogue of some other function, and it keeps going back to the point where there was an assignment or an initialization of the object. And again, we get the global proof by piecing together these local steps. And each step is in just one neighborhood. And again, we have these weasel words, more recently than the L value appears to have been destroyed. Here's the first part of fixing the weasel words. We're going to invent a new capability, destructible. It works exactly the same way. Destructible has no effect when destructible has been previously asserted for that L value. Including as a consequence of construction, you get destructible for free by constructing an object. And again, we care about it only in the responsible neighborhood. And more recently than the L value appears to be destroyed, the weasel words are still there. And again, otherwise the behavior is undefined. So like the others, this can still, in a lazy implementation or in an implementation that just wants your code to go fast, it can be implemented as an empty function. Nothing has to be done in an undefined behavior case, and nothing at all is done in the defined behavior case. So the function could be implemented as an empty function, or it could be implemented as something that actually keeps track. And the keeping track version would be much nicer for debugging, but the empty function version much nicer for making your code go fast. So, with that in hand, let's look back at the mysterious gap I told you about in the calling neighborhood. The calling neighborhood has this gap where the implementation appears. We know something happens there, but we can't see it. We need to put some limits on what can happen there so that we can reason about what happens afterwards. And here are some things that we can say. Anything that's locally readable to the implementation might be read from. Anything that's locally writable might be written to. Anything that's locally destructible might be destroyed. So in the prologue, we saw what capabilities were asserted, and we expect the implementation might use those capabilities. But more importantly, we expect the implementation won't use the capabilities that we have that we didn't pass to the implementation. That is, if we have a variable that's readable to us, and we don't, and it's not mentioned in the prologue, then we assume that the implementation doesn't look at our variable. And that should be kind of obvious. We declare a variable, we don't pass it as a parameter, we expect the implementation doesn't use that variable. Similarly, we have a variable that we didn't give the implementation permission to write to by saying it was writable in the prologue. The implementation doesn't get to write to our variable. And finally, if the prologue doesn't say that the variable is destructible, the implementation won't destroy our variable. So we expect that the capabilities we reserve from the implementation, the ones that we don't, that aren't mentioned in the prologue, won't get used by the implementation. And that gives us a way to talk about what functions destroy objects. If the function doesn't claim destructibility in its prologue, we can say it's not going to destroy the object. And that gets rid of a whole host of those earlier problems, because destroying objects willy-nilly can cause an awful lot of undefined behavior. And that leaves us to another question. Should we make destructible part of the basic interface like we made readable and writable part of the basic interface? That is, should destructible be part of proper? Is that a usual expectation when we pass a reference to an object into a function? And you could say, some functions do need that expectation, but really those are dangerous functions. I'm gonna say the basic interface doesn't pass destructibility. If you want destructibility to go from one function to another, you have to say so when you write down the function's interface. But there are a couple of cases where destructibility is needed in the basic interface, and that's these. If we return a value of an object type, that is not a reference, then we had better return a destructible object of that value type, because otherwise the caller isn't going to be able to ever destroy it. Likewise, if we throw an exception, we had better throw a destructible exception, because at some point that exception has to go away. I'm not actually showing you the crazy code that you can write to violate these expectations, but if you want a little puzzle, you can go home and try to figure out how to throw an exception that is not destructible. There are a couple of other places. In a constructor, we have a claim of destructibility automatically in a constructor, it's not a claim, it's a posit. It's actually, I'm fudging just a little bit here, but posit is the other assertion. Posit is the universal quantifier over execution paths. This is how you introduce a thing that never was known before. You say, I'm just going to assume this is true. So posit is the dangerous assertion. We won't be seeing very much of it. But at the end of a constructor, we can posit that the object is destructible, because that's where it happens. Likewise, if the constructor fails, the exception has to be destructible. In a destructor, the other side of the slide, we claim destructibility at the top of the destructor for the last time. This is where destructibility goes away. And you shouldn't destroy an object if it's not destructible, and that's where it gets enforced. Same thing, if the destructor fails, the exception still has to be destructible. There's a little bit more to say about constructors and destructors. There's a couple of assertions. I'm not going to go into the details of just what these mean, but I think that we can agree that there are places you are allowed to construct an object, and there are places where you're not allowed to construct an object. And I'm going to say unoccupied space means it's okay to construct an object here. So a constructor takes unoccupied space and turns it into a destructible object. And a destructor takes a destructible object and turns it into unoccupied space. And again, we see the bit in the exceptional epilogue. We don't claim more than the exceptional epilogue than we had coming in. If the constructor fails, we're back to unoccupied space. If the destructor throws an exception, it turns out the sub-object destructors still run. We still get back to unoccupied space. So constructors and destructors get you from unoccupied space to destructible object and back. And this shouldn't be too surprising, I think. I know I'm saying tons of obvious things. The basic interface is about saying the obvious things. But here, trying to write them all down. Let's see. Okay, let's try out destructibility. And how much time do I have? 10 minutes. Okay, I'll see. We might have to break in the middle of this section and I'll back up, but here we go. This is the fool's assignment operation. Instead of doing an assignment, we're going to destroy the object and construct a new one in its place. And because we're doing it that way, we're going to claim destructible in our prologue. And then we can, as usual, wonder what could possibly go wrong. Here is something that could possibly go wrong. We claim destructible in our prologue, but after we destroyed the object, we created a new one, and we didn't tell the caller that that was destructible. And so when the caller implicitly tries to destroy the object we created, it can't, because that object appears to have been destroyed already. That's us keeping track of appears to have been destroyed. This interface appears to destroy the object that's passed in. And of course, that's a problem that causes code that we thought should work to not compile. Worse would be this code. Here, we have created the object on the heap. And there is no implicit destructor here. The destructibility of this object that was created by the implementation has been lost. It can't ever be destroyed. But we didn't notice. We've just leaked that object. We don't like leaking our objects. So I'm going to say, at the end of a function, here at the end of the epilogue, at the point where responsibility is transferred, there has to be no leaked destructibility. That is, all the destructibility that was known to the implementation at that point has to have been mentioned in the epilogue. So I can't just let the destructibility fall flat on the floor in the epilogue. It has to get passed back. And that gets rid of our memory leak. In this case, it doesn't actually get rid of the problem there, but we can add in a claim of destructible to get around that. Now we had destructibility at the end of the epilogue, but we mentioned it, so we're okay. It's not leaked. And similarly, if there's an exception, no leaked destructibility. We want all the destructibility to stay in play until the object is destroyed. We can ask one more question. What about readability and writability? Do we want the readability and writability to necessarily stay in play till the object is destroyed? There is a weak argument against. Apart from destruction, there aren't any operations that get rid of readability or writability. I mean, somebody at the last talk brought up some Unix syscall that actually does, but for the most part, no. But here's the important point. If we keep the readability and writability in play, we can say, you have to have them in hand at the point where the destruction happens. That is, if destruction requires the readability and writability, we can know that the readability and writability are gone after destruction, because the interface for destruction is going to take those capabilities in and not give you them on the way out. And I think that's a pretty good place to break for to have our break. Are there any questions before we go? No questions.
How does this generalize to all other operations against a valid?
Excellent question. Excellent question. The question is, how does this generalize to all other operations for a value? More generally, we're going to have to be able to invent new sorts of capabilities, mostly by combining existing readability and writability in interesting ways. And these capabilities can be associated with proper for a particular type, so that we know a proper vector, for example, will have the ability to read and write its elements. Or a proper const vector would have the ability to read its elements. So invent the appropriate capability, name the most usual set of capabilities for the object proper, and that brings them into the basic interface. Anything else? Yes?
Well, I don't know why this, apart from destruction, things are caught.
Why do I think the fact that very few operations forget readability and writability is a con for making not leaking readability and writability part of the basic interface? I suppose you might think that it's needlessly complicating the basic interface to say something so obvious. Now that I think about it, the basic interface is all about complicatedly saying things that should be obvious. So maybe that's not much of a con at all. I agree. It's a very weak argument. But I'm against it. I am pro on this issue. So I just tried to make the best other side I could. Anything else? I guess it's time to take a break.